Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Hi, Tom.
G'day, Phil.
How are you, mate?
Good.
The Tesla Model Y has just gone on sale. Now, this is the kind of SUV version of Australia's best-selling electric car.
Yeah, the Model 3. So it's it's got a higher body, so it's 18 centimetres higher, about 5 centimetres longer and 7 centimetres wider.
But I had a look at the picture. It doesn't look that different from the Model 3.
No, certainly the design is very similar. And if you sit in the driver's seat, it's essentially the same. It's got the same dashboard, centre console, seats. Everything in the front is identical to a Model 3. There's a couple of tiny specification differences. So, for example, the Model Y gets a slightly better sound system with subwoofers and things like that. And it also gets 19-inch wheels versus 18-inch wheels on the base model of the Model 3. Mm-hmm. But you pay more for it. So it's actually it's about $5,000 more. So $74,000 roughly drive away, depending on what state you live in. And that actually puts it just out of reach of the rebates that are offered in most places.
I read that. Yeah, I read that because that's right.
So that $3,000 or in WA $3,500
makes it suddenly more expensive.
That's right. So $5,000 is how much more Tesla's charging, but you're effectively paying about $8,000 more than that Model 3. So it's a significant step up in terms of price. But in terms of the space, the rear seat space, a lot more rear seat headroom. And certainly the boot space is a lot more than the Model 3. So more of a traditional or more SUV-like in terms of the design.
Have you had a go at this yet?
I've actually got one here tonight, but I can't tell you what it's like until next week. So
because of the reveal.
They basically said to a bunch of media, you can drive it this week, but you can't tell anyone what you think of it yet. So
give me the thumbs up or down.
look, I think if you like a Model 3, you'll probably like this one.
Yeah,
yeah. So it's interesting. Yeah, look, and sales-wise,
whatever they're doing, Tesla, they're doing it. I mean, obviously people are responding, aren't they? Because
absolutely. I
mean, it's the runaway bestseller.
Yeah. So that Model 3. So Tesla, that single model, they've outsold the entire Lexus range, for example, and the entire Skoda range. So they're doing unbelievably well with a single model. So this is suddenly a second model in the lineup, and you could argue a model that's appealing more to what people want to buy these days. Those SUVs sitting up a bit higher, obviously.
People like all the folding seats and the luggage room and all that sort of stuff. Stick a bicycle in there, all that.
Yeah, absolutely. So look, from that perspective, you'd have to say that this car is, you would think, going to sell a bit better than the Model 3. We obviously won't know that, but it only went on sale last Friday, so it went on sale Friday morning. And as they listed it on the Tesla Australia website, they were initially quoting that deliveries could be had in between August and November, I think it was. So as early as August, a couple of months away.
Mm.
If you go on and order one now, it's as late as May next year. So they've had to stretch it twice, the estimated time of deliveries. Now, considering they're doing over 1,000 Model 3s a month, you'd think that they might be doing similar of this. So they could be sitting on 8,000 plus orders. So
it's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
They've obviously learned from Henry Ford. You know how, remember, he used to say with the Model T, you can order it in any colour you like as long as it's black?
Yeah.
I noticed with this one, if you order it in white, the same price. If you order it in any other colour, every other colour costs more.
And that's why if you look at Model 3, there are so many white Model 3s around.
Because I noticed it because I was thinking this the other day. Why do I see so many white Teslas? That's the reason. Any other colour, it's another $3,000 or something.
Well, it's $1,500 for most of the colours, but the red is $2,900. So that's the biggest step up again. But look,
What's the story?
The story is they've decided to have one standard colour, if you like, and then the rest of them so-called premium colours where they can charge extra. And look, they're not alone in doing this. Most car makers do charge a lot more than it costs to put metallic fleck and so on in the paint, even though the white colour on Teslas is metallic as well, or pearl or something. If you look at it, it's interesting because I was looking through some of the Tesla international websites and I got to Hong Kong because that's sort of similar to Australia in terms of they source their cars from China and so on. And I looked at theirs, and over there, the black is the standard colour. So the colour that we have to pay $1,500 for,
it's free.
It's
free.
And if they want white, they have to pay extra for it, even though we get a standard.
It's a joke.
It's clearly about, we'll offer one for this price, but all the other colours, off you go. So, but anyway.
Anyway, it's out there, but don't think you'll be driving it soon.
No, okay. Well, you can be driving it if you go and test drive one, but you mightn't be driving your one until 2023. But
now, end of financial year used to be good if you're trying to buy a new car because there was always a run out sales and you know, full page ads everywhere.
Yeah,
in the days when there were pages. But however, don't expect that this year.
Don't expect it this year, no. I mean, look, the deals have pretty much dried up. Look, car companies on specific models, sometimes you get, you know, a base model Toyota Hilux, for example. There seem to be a fair few of those floating around. So those, for example, they do have some sort of incentives on. And some of the luxury brands, quite a few of the luxury brands actually do have certain models, again, where they might have a bit of excess stock and they're trying to clear that out.
Yep.
But no, generally, you know, most of those deals have dried up. And the sort of the incentives you're starting to see more now tend to revolve around finance offers and so on. So they're trying to, I guess, get people in and sign up to their finance, which is often where on a new car they can make more money, is out of the finance and insurance and so on. So it's they're trying to sign people up with that. But yeah, don't go in thinking you're going to, you know, get $5,000 off the price or something, because it's pretty unlikely, I'd imagine.
Hey, did you see the Victorian government today said that they're going to keep the Formula One, the Grand Prix, for another 10 years, saying but the deals are commercial in confidence.
Yeah, right. Which means they're paying a heap of money for it.
They must have paid a stack for it.
Look,
that's how it works.
It is. Yeah, it's a big investment for governments, and it has been controversial in the past how much the Victorian government has spent on it. But yeah, obviously we don't know how much. But you'd imagine it'd have to come out at some point. I mean, it's taxpayer money, and you would have thought in the budget somewhere. it might have to be revealed.
Yes, all right. Now, what else? The Land Rover's got an eight seat Defender coming out.
They have, yes. Yeah. So, and this sort of revives a fairly famous variant. So, anyone who knows their older Land Rovers will know that the numbers. So, you had the Defender 90, the little short 2-door one, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, and the numbers referred to the wheelbase in inches. So it was basically the cars got longer. But if you look at the they've just released the 130, which gets, as you say, eight seats, but it's got exactly the same wheelbase as the 110. So they've got the same wheelbase. All they've done is tacked a bit more on the back of the car, so extended the rear overhang, so they can fit in more or bigger seats in the back there, give a bit more luggage space and so on, and make it more of a, I guess, a family touring off-roader rather than the cool-looking ones between the 90 and the 110. So, look, the challenge with all of those Defenders at the moment is getting hold of them. They've got enormous queues on them to the point where people are, you know, they're getting so few of them in the country that they're actually commanding some pretty good prices on the used car market at the moment too.
Sure. Toby's with us, Motor Talk. If you'd like to ask him a question, 1-300-800-222. The new Nissan Z is on sale if you like sports cars. It's got a lot more power. It's got more power than a Porsche, actually.
More than the base model Porsche 911. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So new twin turbo V6 engine. So they typically had naturally aspirated engines in the Nissan Z cars, and the engines have got progressively bigger with the model names that have gone with them. You know, 260, 280 Zs, 2.6, 2.8 litres up to the more recent 370 Z. So it's actually gone backwards in engine capacity. So it's down to a 3-litre twin turbo V6. But as I said, it's added the turbochargers. So more grunt, 298 kilowatts. The entry-level Porsche 911's only 283 kilowatts. So, but that said, it's also gone up in price. So it's priced from around about $80,000. Looks pretty cool though. They've sort of got some of the retro styling, but it still looks like a modern sports car. And it's looking like being fairly popular. They've sold out of the launch model, the original sort of higher grade launch model. Getting hold of one could be a challenge in one of those as well. But could be an exciting car.
Speaking of which, Nissan is going to launch its e-Power hybrid in Australia too. Now, this is just a straight hybrid, isn't it? It's got a petrol engine which charges the batteries.
It is, but done very differently. So with a Toyota hybrid, for example, or the hybrid systems that are more common.
Because Toyotas basically own hybrids, don't they?
They do. They're over 90% of the hybrid market, and they've led the discussion on hybrids. But But Nissan's doing it quite differently. So with a Toyota hybrid, and many people listening now are no doubt driving one, you've got the petrol engine and an electric motor, and they can work together. So there are some instances when the electric motor will drive on its own, but only on very light throttle and usually at pretty low speeds. Mm-hmm. And if you're decelerating, for example, and it decides to cut the engine out, those sorts of scenarios. But you need the petrol engine and you need it to drive the wheels quite regularly in a Toyota hybrid. In the Nissan e-Power, the petrol engine is never going to drive the wheels. So they basically say it has an electric car feel in terms of the way it drives, because you've got that instant torque, you've got the seamlessness of an electric motor. So it does have a petrol engine, but that petrol engine is purely used as a generator. So it sits in there and it can be tuned specifically for doing that job of just creating electricity for the for the electric drive system. So, the first car will appear in the Qashqai, so they're sort of compact SUV, but we're going to see it in more models beyond that as well. So it could be an interesting tech. It's not the first one of those sort of hybrids we've seen before. So BMW, for example, with the iX3, did have a similar system. So they had they called it a Rex, a range extender version, which had a little motorbike engine, actually. So that was the generator. And if you go all the way back, the Holden Volt was basically the same technology. There was one very rare high-speed scenario when the engine actually directly drove the wheels. But for all intents and purposes, it was a similar technology. So it felt like an electric car. It just had that engine as a generator. So, it's interesting technology. It'll be, we haven't seen the numbers on that e-Power, that Nissan e-Power system yet, in terms of fuel use, price, and they're two pretty key things. And that's one thing that Toyota's done extremely well with their hybrids is price them competitively. Mm-hmm. So that'll be key. And also, as I said, the fuel use. I mean, if they can get it, if they can halve fuel use or more than halve fuel use, then it'll be a pretty compelling prospect.
Okay. Now, Chinese cars, you've been driving the Havel Jolyon.
Yeah.
You're really enthusiastic about this, aren't you?
Look, I was very interested to drive this because
What is it?
So it's a larger small SUV.
Right.
So it's starts at around about $26,000. Yeah. I was in the top of the range, $34,000, which is still pretty good these days.
Like a Mazda CX-3 or something, is it?
It's bigger, more like a Mazda CX-30 in terms of size. So that sort of next size up.
Yep.
And I thought I was really looking forward to it. And when you sit in the car, it is seriously impressive in terms of the finishes, the trim, the materials, the attention to detail generally. They've done a terrific job outside as well. It's got just enough chrome. It stands out on the road. You think it looks pretty cool. So all that's really, really impressive. Then you start moving and there are a few challenges once you start getting going. So it hasn't got the most intelligent transmission in the world. It could do with a bit of work on that. It just seems to be...
So it's good when it's parked, basically.
Great when it's parked. It's terrific when it's parked.
What do you reckon's the best of the Chinese brands? Is that a big... That's maybe too hard.
Look, they're all... I mean, they're selling at the moment on price.
People are keen, that's right, but they're keen on price, aren't they? Yeah,
people are keen on price. And that's how a new brand busts into the market. They say, we've got to try and undercut the existing brands in there, give people a reason to at least consider us, and then once you get them in the showroom, you baffle them with all the gear it's got and off you go. So, look, actually, Havel does a pretty good job of they will address the issues, I think, pretty quickly. They know there's some problems there in terms of, some of the warnings and so on it gives you, it gets a bit testing. You end up with this car that's beeping at you constantly to try and tell you all sorts of stuff.
That's annoying.
Keep your eyes on the road, do this, do that.
That's annoying.
So little things like that. They'll get feedback, they'll refine that. So as I said, Havel's a pretty good one. Look, MG is getting better as well. Mm-hmm. They have issues. Their base model car, the MG3, it could do with some more safety gear in there. Their cars, they lack the finer points of dynamic ability and so on. So they're not... they don't always drive as well as some of the better established competitors. But look, you only have to look at the sales to realise that these brands are making a significant impact, and they're going to keep going that way, I think.
They haven't been there long enough to know what the resale history is. That's one question mark over them, isn't it?
It is, but so take the, you know, the commercial vehicle market's an interesting one. So you've got, you know, Toyota Hiace, for example, really dominates in that van market.
Hmm.
You can get into some of those Chinese ones, LDVs and so on, for $15,000 to $20,000 less than a Hiace. Right. And when you're a business operator and the business operators are saying, okay, that's $15,000 or $20,000 I can keep in the business now, and I'm going to run the car for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, and if it's got a warranty that's five, six, seven years.
That's right.
Mm. Then it's not as much of an issue. They sort of say, okay, well, it doesn't matter if it's not worth that much because I paid $15,000 or $20,000 less for it at the start. So, yeah, I mean, in some instances, it's not a major issue. But, yeah, I mean, typically new brands do struggle a bit when it comes to resale because people, not everyone is prepared to give them a go.
No. All right, let's take some calls. Here's the number. Lines are free if you want to grab one. Ian from Newcastle's first up. Hi, Ian.
Oh, g'day, Phil. G'day, Toby. Thanks for taking the call.
Pleasure.
Yeah, I'm interested in buying an EV, and I've been looking at the ranges of different models. I'm just wondering what are the standards for range and which one gives the closest to real-world range, and do they run the car batteries till they're dead flat doing the range checks? And I've heard that that's not such a great idea for battery life. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks, Toby.
So, yeah, look, battery life, lithium-ion batteries, which is what is used in all battery electric vehicles, as well as smartphones and laptop computers and so on, they don't always like being topped right up, so absolutely to their maximum, and drained all the way down to the bottom. So, but what an electric car will typically do is it's got software management in there so that you don't actually necessarily use the entire battery range. So when it tells you it's full, it's not full. It's not full according to the basics of the battery. And again, when it tells you it's empty, it's not completely empty. So they have some natural protection built into them so that as a consumer, you can just treat it as normal and go from 100 to zero and so on. That said, a number of the EVs also have a setting in there for charging where you can set the maximum charge limit. So, you know, again, with your phone, you probably take it up to 100 most of the time, 100%. But they might have a maximum limit of, say, 90%. So when you're just driving it around town, each night when you top it up, you're just topping it up to 90% to try and look after that battery a bit more. Then when you want to go on a road trip or a weekend away, you hit the 100% and you bung it up for that that one weekend away sort of thing. So, so there are things you can do like that to look after them. In terms of the battery range, there's a new standard. Well, there's two new standards. There's sort of an American standard and a European standard. Australian cars typically line up with European standards. So there's a standard called the WLTP standard, and it stands for Worldwide Light Harmonized something. I can't remember the last two, but it's basically it's a supposed to be a more accurate measurement of range. It's also used for fuel economy, so for diesel and petrol cars as well, but... So when you're looking for the stats on an electric car, look for that WLTP figure, and you'll find that that is the more accurate in terms of what you're going to actually achieve in the real world. But even then, I would suggest knock about 10% off. So get that WLTP figure, knock about 10% off, and that's about your safe range for most EVs. There's some exceptions to the rule, but that's going to give you a pretty close estimate to where it's at.
Thanks, Ian.
Thanks very much.
No worries. Wendy from Newcastle. We've got lots of listeners in Newcastle tonight. Hi, Wendy.
Hello there, Phil. Toby.
Yeah, good. What's up? What's up, Wendy?
I have a 2018 Hyundai Kona wagon.
Mm-hmm.
It's due for its 75,000 kilometre service this month, but I've got less than 60,000 kilometres. On the odometer, and I'm just wondering what happens at the service. Do they give it the full 75, even though I'm not up there, or do they? I don't know what happens at these services. I'm just curious.
So, with servicing a car, there'll be some items that will need to be replaced at a certain time or date because they just naturally degrade. So, brake fluid, for example, usually is 2 or 3 years. And it doesn't matter if you've done 20,000 Ks or 100,000 Ks, they're going to say put new brake fluid in there. Other parts of the car will potentially go on kilometres. So, for instance, sometimes you might find a timing belt or something like that. They'll say we'll go on kilometres rather than age. So have a chat to the service department. They'll this is a very common thing for service departments. They get that a fair bit, and they'll know the bits to pick out and say, okay, we will do that, we won't do that, and they'll make sure it's done to the book standard, so to make sure your warranty remains intact. But yeah, have a chat to them beforehand and just say, listen, here's the deal. Do I need to have all the parts on that major service? As I said, there will be some things that they're going to want to do anyway because it's just hit the time limit for that particular component or whatever it is, the fluid and so on in there. So yeah, but they'll they deal with all that stuff fairly regularly.
Oh, okay, then. Okay, thank you very much for your help.
No worries, cool. Wendy. Thank you. Toby Hagen's with us. This is Motor Talk. evcentral.com.au, by the way, is Toby's website if you'd like to know anything about electric cars. evcentral.com.au. Stephen from Croydon. G'day, Stephen.
Oh, hi, Phil. Hi, Toby. Subaru's brought out a new version of the WRX. I was wondering if Toby thinks there are any significant differences between it and the previous version, and what are his general thoughts about that car for value for money?
So, unfortunately, I haven't driven that car yet. I have got one coming in the next month or so. I'm due to get into a couple of them, actually, the wagon and the sedan. And as you may be aware, there's some differences to how they've set them up in terms of suspension and so on with the sedan and the wagon. And obviously automatics and manuals and so on. I can't speak from personal experience. I guess I've read what some of my colleagues have said, which is they say it has been softened a bit in terms of the sound. So in terms of, I guess, that rawness that was part of the whole WRX appeal. I guess what I would say is that market has evolved quite a bit. So if you look at, obviously, WRX is one of the long-standing ones, 1994, I think that came to Australia. And you've got, obviously, Volkswagen Golf GTI as another one that's a very solid contender in that market. But also have a look at some of the other options. So a Hyundai i30N, for example, is a terrific hot hatch in that market. It's, they've come out with really their first proper hot hatch, and they've come out swinging. It's a really terrific little car. So, as I said, I'll be able to enlighten you a bit more on the WRX in the near future, but keep your eyes open to some of those other ones as well.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thanks, Stephen. A couple of text questions here too. Interested in your opinion, this is from Ray. Hi, Ray. Interested in your opinion between the Range Rover Evoque and the Jaguar E-Pace P250.
Yeah, well, obviously those cars share some components in terms of engines and so on, depending on which engine you're getting in.
Ray reckons there's some, by the way, some standard features are missing due to the semiconductor shortage, for example. No change in pricing, but the heads-up display and the 3D surround cameras are not there.
Well, that's interesting, the pricing, because so that's not uncommon. There's a number of brands that have done that recently, everything from Ford, Mercedes-Benz, Audi, Volkswagen. There's a bunch of brands that are doing that, taking equipment out. Most of them are offering compensation. So they're basically saying, okay, you're missing out on this, you're missing out on this and this, so we're going to give you $500 back for that, $750 for that, and so on. I hadn't heard of much of, it's a bit cheeky to be saying, well, we're going to take it all out, and by the way, bad luck, you're not getting anything back. So yeah, that's a bit full on. But in terms of, which one was it, the F-Pace or the E-Pace Jag?
It was the Jag, E-Pace 2, yeah, the 250.
So I guess the E-Pace is smaller, so the Evoque's going to be a larger car. The one thing, obviously, the Range Rover's got in its favour, despite the fact that that Evoque is, it's a fairly sporty-looking Range Rover, so it's got, door handles that fold in and a fairly sleek look to it. But it still has all the off-road hardware. So it's a pretty serious off-roader in terms of what it can do. It's the biggest limiting factor with that car will be the tyres. So, they chuck these enormous tyres on it. They're usually fairly low profile and more about driving on a German autobahn than belting over rocks and rubble. So so the Range Rover's going to have, I guess, that far more ability in terms of rough road ability, if that's important to you. It does still do a terrific job for on-road, and it's those sportier Range Rovers are a terrific vehicle for that sort of thing. So I'd be tending a bit towards the Range Rover, I guess, for that breadth, for having, both sides of the spectrum sort of covered off. That said, the Jag's going to be be slightly, you know, it'll. I think it'll be a little bit more frugal with that the P250, a 250 horsepower engine, and also, you know, style. I mean, you've got the, you know, it's a different, it's certainly a very, it's more of a, I guess, a city-focused SUV than a hardcore off-roader, and it gets a bit more of that that Jag style going on as well.
Mm. Okay, Jan says, what's better value, top-of-the-line Kia Sorento or top-of-the-line Toyota Highlander?
So that'd be a Kluger Highlander, I would imagine.
Would have to be, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so... So straight away, the Kluger will be larger. So you'll notice that they're both classified as large SUVs, but the Kluger's fractionally bigger. So it's so you're going to have a bit more space, mainly in that third row seat. So in the you know, in the very back row, if you're putting, you know, teenage kids in there, for example, they're going to be a little bit happier with their legroom in the Kluger than they will in the Sorento. The Sorento gets a diesel. The Kluger doesn't. The Kluger gets a hybrid. And the Sorento does get hybrids, but they're pretty expensive. It's got a plug-in hybrid and a regular hybrid these days. So between the two of them, in terms of value, look, probably the I'd probably inch towards the Sorento.
Hmm.
But, you know, it's got an extra 2 years of warranty. It's got the option of, as I said, of that diesel engine, which works pretty nicely in it. And it's got a heap of gear in it. So, it's yeah. So yeah, I'd probably edge towards that.
And Jacqueline in Randwick, hi Jack, says, Toby, love the show. What are your thoughts on the new Genesis EV? Like the look of them, are they worth the dough?
Well, we don't know the dough yet, so that's the slight challenge.
Mm-hmm.
is where they're going to be priced in terms of where they sit. So they've actually got three EVs coming. So to work out which one you're thinking of, so they're going to have the G80, which is a sedan, a large sedan.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have the GV70, which is their mid-sized SUV. Now, both those cars will be adapted to internal combustion engine platforms. So they're going to take the existing structures
mm-hmm.
and basically fit the battery packs in there, take the engines out and so on. Whereas they've got another one coming called the GV60, and that is a ground-up electric vehicle. So that, to me, is the more interesting one of all these cars. Now, the GV60 is based on the Hyundai Ioniq 5 and the Kia EV6. So it's the more luxurious, sportier version of the Hyundai and the Kia. And now the Hyundai starts at around the $75,000 mark. The Kia is a fraction cheaper. But so it's safe to assume that GV60 is probably going to be sort of 90 or 100 grand, possibly more. So it does have some interesting technology. They've got, they've given it some pretty slick performance in terms of acceleration and also technology such as facial recognition when you're getting into the car that then sets the car up.
Oh, yeah.
and some pretty funky design elements as well with, you know, a crystal sphere sort of thing in the center console. So it's a bit different in that regard. But as I said, we don't know the exact price on that yet. We don't know. I haven't driven it yet. I think there's some development cars in the country. Well, there definitely are because I've seen them them on the road. But yeah, we just need to live and learn a bit more about that.
Okay, all right. Calls back to John in Mossman. G'day, John.
Good evening. Just an inconsequential point of interest.
Yeah.
The reason all the Fords were black originally was because Henry went to old Héritier DuPont, for whom I worked, and he said, I'm going to produce cars that will come off the production line every 20 minutes, and I need a paint that'll dry that fast. And DuPont only made gunpowder, which was black. And he said, well, you can have paint, but it'll be black.
Is that right, or is that a joke?
That's an absolute fact.
Is that why the cars used to go bang, 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 bang?
Well, quite possibly. And on top of that, I knew Toby's father really well. Anyway, love the program.
We all know Toby's father really well. We love him too.
Okay, bye.
On you, John. Thank you. Bye-bye. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Bob from Augusta. G'day, Bob. Hi, Bob.
G'day, guys. Thanks for the show.
Pleasure.
I've got a 2021 Mazda CX-5, and to get that, we traded in a 2019 Mazda 3 with a 2.5-litre petrol, and the current CX-5's got the 2.5-litre petrol as well, basically the same motor, I believe. The fuel economy in the CX-5 seems to be disappointingly worse compared with the Mazda 3. I know there's weight and whatever involved. The car itself is fantastic to drive, but just wondering whether Toby's got any comments on that.
Yeah, well, look, you're right. It's the same engine that they update the engines, you know, each year or two. They'll throw a few more kilowatts at it, and sometimes you'll get a slightly different tune between different models, but it is the same basic engine. But look, I think what you're experiencing there is the extra weight of the CX-5 and also the extra frontal area. So it's a bigger vehicle that has to push more air out of the way. So sitting at 100, 110 on the freeway, you're having to shift more air, and you're also having to, as I said, drag more weight up to 110 k's an hour as well. So it's just purely physics kicking in and making the engine work a bit harder. And sometimes those smaller, it's not a small engine, but I guess if you start talking about six cylinders, bigger six cylinders and so on, that can be fairly lazy in terms of relying on their torque to get going. But sometimes with engines, those four-cylinder engines, when you start putting them in some bigger cars, not that the CX-5 is a huge car, but a bigger car than the Mazda 3, it's going to have to work a bit harder. And it's going to have to, you're potentially revving it a bit more and getting it out of its sweet spot in terms of efficiency potentially. So, as I said, it's just it's weight and aerodynamics would be the two things contributing to that. You've also got, another factor at play here is potentially tyres, rolling resistance of tyres. So often if you get a car with wider tyres and more aggressive, sportier tyres that sometimes have a softer compound, then you'll find that again, they don't roll quite as freely. So the engine's got to work just a fraction harder. It might only be 2-3%, but a fraction harder to keep the car going. So the tyres can make a big difference as well. And you get that on electric cars. That's where you really start noticing on electric cars. They'll say, oh, okay, if you step up to this set of wheels with these tyres on them, you'll lose 30 kilometres of range or something off the EV.
What's interesting is the fact that I find the automatic and matched with this particular motor is much smoother than the Mazda 3 I had before. And once again, I guess that's just an individual thing.
Yeah, maybe, and it could also be the weight dulling it a bit. So maybe helping dull those gear shifts a bit more rather than having a bit of jerkiness between the
fantastic
shifts.
Fantastic car to drive. I'm really wrapped. I got it, but just a query about the fuel economy.
Yeah,
on you, Bob.
These days.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
Good on you. Bye bye. Neil from Canberra. Hi, Neil.
Yes. Good evening.
Hi.
Toby, I've got an old 2005 Toyota Hilux SR5, and I'm just going to try and replace the wheels for it. It's going really well. I've had Coopers on them for nearly 10 years. The R15 seems to be causing issues. Can I go to an R16 rim without affecting ADR rules or whatever?
So this is something it will depend on. So when you're saying R15, R16, for other people who aren't aware, that he's talking 15-inch diameter or 16-inch diameter wheel. And often when you step up an inch in wheel, they will put a slightly lower profile tyre on there to try and keep the rolling circumference speedo of the tyre the same, basically, which then, keeps the speedo in check. So there are various rules around this, and sometimes I believe they vary state to state. So you'd have to check it for the state that you're in and make sure that you're adhering to the rules. But often what you can do, so if that particular car, if that model, obviously Hilux, as they did, a whole range of models, as you say, SR5 all the way down to your workmates and so on, and they'll have a range of different tyres and so on that are available depending on the model within that lineup. So often you can change to the same to a tyre that was or a wheel that was also available on that car, but keep it and keep the speedo and so on in check again, provided you're keeping the tyre size within the dimensions of what was specified for the car within in terms of that other model within the range. And sometimes I believe you can step up an inch in diameter as well, but again, all of this depends on the state you live in. A reputable tyre or wheel retailer will know all that stuff off the top of their head. They'll have that that detail in their head, and you'll find it. You generally find it online relatively easily in terms of how it applies to the various states and so on. But be careful. And the other thing you need to be aware of is potential insurance implications. So, even before you do it, chat to your insurance company and say, listen, I'm going to put these wheels and tyres on it. What will that do to my insurance? And again, they might be able to give you the clue too and say, well, actually, no, you're going to break the rules if you do that. Or yes, we allow you to go up an inch and so on.
Mm. Okay. Thanks.
One other question. GPS units. Has any model come out with traffic sign recognition on them yet?
You mean aftermarket?
Built in. Aftermarket, yes, aftermarket.
I'm not aware of aftermarket ones that that have that. Certainly a lot of, most modern cars. I mean, a lot of, Toyotas, Mazdas, Nissans and so on will have that sort of speed limit recognition and so on. I'm not aware of aftermarket ones because they'd obviously need a forward-facing camera to then go recognising what speed zone they're in. There are two ways that those systems work too. Some of them just work off the sat-nav data, so they're working purely off the data that's programmed into the mapping system, and others have the forward-facing camera. And the advantage of having the forward-facing camera, basically they still rely on the mapping, so they've still got the mapping data there, the speed limit data on the maps. But the advantage of having the forward-facing camera is if you come into a roadwork zone, for example, it'll pick up that roadwork sign and it'll tell you that you're now in a 40 zone or whatever it might be. So they're smarter, I guess. They tend to pick that up. And look, the other thing is the mapping data I've had,
Delays?
Not necessarily delays, but mistakes. So often there was a street near my house where a lot of them were out of whack. They were 10K out of whack. So it relies on the data input or putting the right data into the mapping system. So I'm not aware of any aftermarket ones. I'm not saying they don't exist. I'm just not aware of them because, as I said, it would start to get a bit complex with having a camera and so on involved with it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Neil. Bye-bye. Bye. 1-300-800-222. There's a bloke called Will Hagen, whoever he is, who's texted in. Evening, Will. How are you? Evening, Will. Lovely to hear from you. Will says, by the way, the Ford Motor Company was founded on this day in 1903.
There you go.
And he also confirms John's story about the quick drying black paint. It's true, he says. Well, Will.
There you go.
Good on you, Will. Nice to hear from you too. 1-300-800-222. This is Motor Talk and Toby Hagen. Apple that hasn't fallen far from the tree from Will is with us this evening. G'day, Vin. Hello. Hi, Vin.
G'day. How you going, Toby?
Not bad.
Mate, just want to have a chat about an old school thing that I'm doing at the moment. I've been a Falcon bloke all my life.
Yep.
And driven Falcons till the cows come home, and had loved my Falcon RTV and had Rangers PX1 to PX3. Brilliant cars, Australian designed and engineered.
Yeah.
Waiting on my next-gen Ranger and enjoying and loving the fact that I'm driving my RTV that was my Sunday drive.
Yeah.
Every day.
Well, it was pretty
cool.
Have
you had a chance?
I went to the RTV launch, yeah. I mean, and we did some pretty serious off-roading in it because obviously it was only two-wheel drive, but it had that locking rear diff, so you could get over some pretty good terrain. Although that said, I think I was driving with Jeff Pilates back then, the boss of Ford Australia, and we got bogged, so he had to help push us out. So it was a very challenging track, and I think it was at the Ford Proving Ground. But the RTV was a terrific, and it was a great example of, as you say, that local engineering, saying they looked at the market and said, hang on, there are some farmers who don't necessarily need a full-on four-wheel drive and don't want to pay for it, but at the same time, they'd like a bit of ground clearance, they'd like a bit more traction if it gets a bit muddy, and there you go. The RTV was born.
Oh, mate, it's been... I did 250,000 Ks in my first one, and this one now, like I said, it's an in-between car.
Yeah.
It's a great Sunday drive that I've got.
Yeah.
Waiting for the new next-gen. Have you driven the next-gen? Because I'm waiting for mine. It's due on
Ranger.
The 25th of July. Yeah, have you driven it? I've
driven one of them, the Raptor, but I'm not allowed to talk about that either. So that's another one that's under embargo. But I haven't driven the regular Rangers and obviously the new V6 diesel. But I am driving it on I think it's July 12, somewhere around there. So
Can I ask you a question then? And it's one thing that I really want because middle-aged bloke. No kids, couple of dogs. I really want a wild track the super cab version, right? I want the 1.8 litre. I've been used to the Falcons for all my life and all my youth.
So you don't want a dual cab, basically.
That's what I really want. Yeah. And can you help us, Tobes? Can you help us?
Well, what you need to do...
Forward. We want Ford to bring it out.
So you need to find a few thousand friends who want the same thing, because if the demand's there... They'll go, yeah, we'll do that now because there's enough demand. But the Utes in particular, they create enormous challenges for car companies because you consider, you know, they have often three body styles, then they have often two or three engine choices, then two-wheel drive, four-wheel drive, then you got the colours, then you got the trims. So, I mean, they can have over 100 variants of that one Ute. So at some point, the product planning department has to start saying, hang on a minute, let's chop that one. We're only selling, you know, 50 or 100 a year. We'll chop that colour. We'll get rid of that trim, whatever it might be. So they start going through it and picking bits out. But as I said, if the demand's there, if enough people are saying we want that, then they will do it. But what they're finding in that, I guess, the top end of the Ute market where they put all the equipment in there and load them up with gear, they're finding that most people are wanting the dual cabs because they want to treat them as family cars and, you know, have...
What happened to us blokes that had the extra? Come on!
They've left
Come
you behind.
Oh, dear. What happened to the lonely middle-aged male enthusiast?
Exactly. Yes.
Carry on, Vin. You've got a friend in the program here, mate. Don't worry. Thanks for the call. Bye-bye. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Sangy from Blacktown. G'day, Sangy.
Hey, Phil. Hey, Toby.
Yep. Hello. Hi.
Hey, I've got a question. I drive a 2013 Holden Cruise, and I only ever pump 91 unleaded. But I've been told by a Holden mechanic that, you know, 98 is the way to go. I just wanted to understand from your perspective, you know, whether you see a real difference in fuel economy and whether it's worth the 20 extra cents per litre.
The tests I've done in the past, you definitely see an improvement in fuel economy. But I also, we've never seen that improvement match the price premium for premium unleaded fuel. So I think almost certainly you would see the car will travel further, but I think you'll also end up spending more fuel doing it. So give it a try for two or three tanks and obviously, you know, you've got a fair idea of what you get out of it now. Give it a try for two or three tanks. And as I said, I think you will find you get that. I remember probably 15 years ago now, we did that test with Toyota Camrys. So we got three Toyota Camrys. And I specifically wanted Camrys because it was a pretty bland engine. It was a mainstream car. And we went and tested E10, so 10% blend of ethanol with petrol, and regular unleaded and also premium unleaded. And as I said, every step up, we noticed they got more efficient. So we had better efficiency in the cars. But I think from an economical perspective, it was the regular unleaded that did best. So it was, there's another factor at play here. And I've chatted to mechanics who say, you know, a high kilometre engine, you know, 150, 200,000 Ks plus, when they take the head off and have a look inside, they reckon they can tell when a car has been running on premium unleaded its whole life. And the fuel companies obviously come out and say that they put extra cleaning products and so on in the fuels, in those premium fuels. You know, whether they do or not, who knows? But as I said, I've had mechanics tell me that they think they can, they reckon they know when they pull the head off an engine if it's been running on that. So there is potentially some circumstantial evidence there to suggest that, but who knows?
Hmm.
Thanks,
Angie. Bye. 1-300-800-222. I don't know whether we can answer your question, Paul, but maybe let's have a crack. Hi, Paul from Townsville.
Oh, good evening, Philip and Toby. How are you this evening?
Not too bad. What's that? What's your son done?
I've got a 1.9 TDI automatic Golf BW.
Yep.
BXE 14 8 valve.
He's put petrol in it, yeah?
He's put petrol in it?
He filled it up. It's a diesel.
Yeah.
He filled it up with AdBlue.
Filled it up with AdBlue?
Crikey.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
Well, some servos have got the pumps, haven't they?
Servos have got bowsers.
Well, the servo, admittedly, the servo that he did it at, it was a pump that had both small nozzles for AdBlue and diesel in the one unit.
Oh, okay.
And
in his defense, you're saying, Paul, yeah.
Yes, I'm defending him.
And Did he? How far did he drive the car?
On air, perhaps not.
But anyway. Yeah, no, come on, be a dad. You've got to defend it. That's right.
And how far did he drive the car afterwards?
Well, the car didn't start afterwards because it was basically a full tank of AdBlue.
Yeah.
And because he tried to start it for quite a while, it went through the whole system.
What's AdBlue? It's urea, basically, isn't it?
Yeah, basically.
It's urea, essentially. And everything I read online and people I asked said that basically it's destroyed the fuel system.
Yeah.
New injectors, new fuel pumps and everything. Now, I actually found a mechanic who used to work for 30 years for Rolls-Royce traveling the world, and he actually got the thing going again without replacing everything.
Okay. Yeah. I have heard of that too, and I've spoken to a mechanic who said, listen, you can bring them back. You can drain it all out and you can, you know, clean the elements out. But look, there are specific companies that will come round to you. Their job is to do this sort of thing. So they'll often come to your house or come to wherever it is that's broken down and clean the system out. So they're used to doing that. So before you go spending the big bucks on replacing all those components, I would be trying one of those systems first, or a mechanic that thinks he can have a crack at it. Because
I'll be honest. The mechanic got it working again.
Hmm.
However, I've noticed that it is a little bit more difficult to start since, and I'm wondering if, you know, like you get the, diesel injector additives or something that you put in the fuel tank. Yeah. Do they really work? Could you think that?
I wouldn't have a clue whether it's going to fix that, because it just depends whether it's, you know, damaged some other component or whether it's, as you're suggesting, clogged up an injector or something. And I wouldn't know where to start. I haven't heard of that, and I don't know what it would chemically or physically be doing in the engine, unfortunately.
Get some expert advice, I think.
Yeah, I'd reckon.
Thanks, Paul. Yep. Easy to do, apparently. One of my texters says, one of my mate's workers did exactly the same thing to his cruiser as well.
It's pretty common petrol in a diesel tank because the petrol nozzles are thinner.
So it happens all the time, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's very rare the other way around. But I was in the Outback, as you know, a couple of months ago, and I saw a mechanic working on a relatively new car, a petrol car, and I said, oh, what's it broken down? And he shook his head. He said, no, one of the junior guys filled it up with petrol. With diesel. I said, how'd he do that? And he started shaking his head again. He said, I don't know, but he managed to do it. Here we are trying to empty it out. So they were, he did manage to get it going again. As I said, the petrol in the diesel is far more common because of the nozzle sizes, but you got to work a bit harder the other way around.
Yep. All right. Look at time has flown. Flown on us, Toby, too. Anything else we're going to talk about too? Oh, Toyota's going to put a manual transmission in the Supra. There you go.
They are.
That's a first.
Yeah, I mean, the Supra has a 3-litre inline 6-cylinder BMW engine. It's built by BMW. It's effectively a BMW that's got Toyota skin around it. And it's only ever been available with an automatic till now. But yeah, you're right. They're going to put a manual in there. So.
Everything old is new again.
Indeed.
All right, Toby. Speak to you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good.
Actually, I won't speak to you in a couple of weeks. I'll be away. But speak to you in a couple of weeks after that.
Sounds cool.
Good on you, Toby Hagen. Yeah, we'll be back with another edition of Motor Talk. Don't forget his website, by the way. EV for electric vehicle, evcentral.com.au. Heaps of information there about electric cars, and answer a lot of your questions too, plus a lot of information, evcentral.com.au.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.